Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Hearing and listening are not the same thing. In the modern age of technology, there are many things that get in the way of active listening. Conscious listening takes effort and intent, and without those, isn't it all just noise? The Someone to Tell It To organization believes that compassionate listening is so powerful as to improve relationships. In fact, they say that all healthy relationships begin with conscious listening that is authentic and non-judgmental. With us today to listen and have a conversation are Michael Gingrich and Tom Caden, co-founders and chief encouragement officers at Someone to Tell It To. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott.
It's great to be here.
Also joining us on the phone is Dr. June Lei Lee, former executive director of the Fred Rogers Center, senior lecturer in early childhood education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He will be the keynote speaker at the Someone to Tell It To event in September 29th. Dr. Lee, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Good morning, Tom and Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, gentlemen, I'm going to ask some of the basic questions about Someone to Tell It To, and then we'll get into a little more about listening and having conversations. But what is Someone to Tell It To? How would you describe it?
Well, we'll tell you about our mission. It is to cultivate meaningful relationships through compassionate listening and training others to do the same. And that's what we do. We listen to people individually. We listen to groups of people, families, couples. We also train. We've done work in hospitals, including just last week, the Hershey Medical Center Cancer Institute, several other healthcare agencies around the mid-state, businesses, nonprofits, schools, churches. We've done work in other organizations in other locations. And so far, furthest away, we've done some training work online in British Columbia through nonprofit leaders there. And that is fascinating. Tomorrow is International Listening Day, and we are going to be partnering with an organization, Alchemy, it's called, in Germany, and doing an online training on listening as well in commemoration of that day.
Mm-hmm. Couple things. When you say we listen, to who? And I know you don't use the word clients, but who do you listen to?
Yeah, we listen to all types of individuals and organizations, team members. We've worked with, I think in 8 years now since we've been in existence, over 8,000 interactions, both with individuals dealing with all kinds of subject matters, depression. You know, the overall pervading issue, though, is a general sense of loneliness and disconnection that we're seeing in the world.
Mm-hmm. When you say compassionate listening, what do you mean by compassionate listening?
We hope that we're listening with empathy, that we can join with people in the way they're feeling, in the sense of, you know, in some ways feeling what they're feeling. That's what empathy means. And that helps us to understand. We do it, you mentioned earlier, non-judgmentally. We don't judge people, whatever they need to tell us, whatever they need to say, whatever's going on. We don't make negative comments about that or tell them that they're wrong or they shouldn't feel that way or talk about what they're talking about. We also don't try to fix people and tell them, again, what to do.
You're not a psychologist.
No, we're not. Most people, well, first of all, not everyone can be fixed. Not everything can be fixed, first. And secondly, people don't like to be told what to do. And if you don't own whatever you might need to do to help your life be better, more whole, and you don't own it yourself, someone telling you what to do often does not help.
Now, I hate to call it a business model because you are a nonprofit, mm-hmm. and you rely solely on donations, but this isn't a unique business model as far as, you know, we are just going to listen to people, not tell them what to do, not give them advice, that kind of thing. But I can picture a lot of lonely people who just need someone to talk to. So, Tom, how did this come about? How did Someone to Tell It To come about?
Well, Michael and I both are trained pastors, and we served in churches, but we say that we had a kind of a special calling to connect with people on a much deeper and broader level. And we still partner with a lot of churches. We had a lot of church support, but we wanted to have a broader reach than just simply through the local church. We still value the local church, but we also wanted to connect with people outside even the Christian faith. We have a lot of people from a variety of faith backgrounds that reach out to us, and we love to engage in relationships with people who may see the world a little bit differently than we do, and yet they still have very similar values.
And including people who don't have any faith, are not sure what they believe, and or maybe don't even believe in God or at all. We really like to connect with everyone, no matter who they are.
So there are times in a conversation that you're having with someone that faith doesn't even come up?
Sometimes. Interestingly enough, we rarely ever have to bring that up, or don't bring that up too often. People will do that themselves. We believe that we all have a spiritual nature. We all, you know, are searching for the meaning in our lives and the purpose for being here. And almost everyone wants to explore that, and we're glad to explore that with them in whatever way they are most comfortable.
Mm-hmm. The people that you have conversations with and you listen to, what do you call them? How do you refer to them?
Someones.
Someones. Yeah.
Because everyone is a someone. Everyone wants to be someone. We all want to matter. We all want to know that we're valued. We want to know that we're loved, that we have significance and meaning. And so we after much, it probably took us 6.5 years to come up with that name. We weren't comfortable with the word client. We didn't know what to use. And finally, we just realized that all of us want to be someone. And so that's what we call them.
So how is someone referred to you? How do you learn of someone that needs listening?
So we've said all along that probably up to now, maybe 95% of the individuals who reach out to us have been referrals. Somebody knows of somebody else who's in a difficult space in their lives, and then they refer them to our organization. But we also have finalized some contracts with various organizations. Like, we have a big contract at a hospital system outside Philadelphia, and we go there, and we're available for doctors, nurses, chaplains, palliative care workers, social workers. For them, they deal with a lot of secondary trauma, and there's high turnover, high burnout rate. So we're able to hopefully provide that safe space so that they can stay emotionally and relationally healthy in their jobs.
So not just patients, then?
Not just patients. We kind of are filling a vacuum in a lot of ways in a hospital system where doctors are often we just find that a lot of caregivers are overlooked, and they're not given the opportunities that they need to be able to process what they're hearing and the compassion that they're offering day in and day out, because compassion fatigue is a real thing. And so we found that that's a real niche for us, is a lot of secondary trauma and high burnout.
You know, I imagine that with dealing with thousands of people, that there probably is not a typical story. But who do you hear from most often? I mean, is there a person that is there a consistency or a theme of people you hear from that say, you know, I really could use someone who would listen to me or have a conversation with me?
We mentioned it briefly a little bit earlier, but and Tom said this, but overall, it's loneliness. We believe that that there's an epidemic of loneliness in this world and disconnection, that in spite of the fact that we can be technologically connected with anyone, anywhere, anytime today in so many ways, that so many of those connections are very shallow. They don't have much depth. And they're not really meeting people's emotional, relational needs in the way that we are all, what we believe, wired to have met. That we're all, you know, we think we created for relationships with one another. And so many of our relationships are just not very, very good.
I know of several people who have lost their spouses, and loneliness is, I mean, they miss their husband or their wife, but they are just so lonely after a few years of being married for years and then being so lonely. I know of one woman that would call the cable company just so she could talk to someone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, loneliness is something that is pervasive. I want to bring Dr. Junlei Li into the conversation. Dr. Li, your specialty is early childhood education and former executive director of the Fred Rogers Center, which the Fred Rogers Center works with not just children, but a lot of people of all ages. You know, what we've been talking about with someone to tell it to, talking about conversations, listening, relationships in so many words. And I think that's what Tom and Michael are talking about. How does that translate when we're talking about children, about younger people?
I think the work of Fred Rogers for young children as well as for their families begin with listening. And that Fred, through his work, was a model of how you listen not just with your ears, but with your eyes, with your heart. And you listen to not just people's words, but you listen to their needs, their joys, their challenges. And in the context of young children, you can imagine that young children, depending on age, are not the most verbally articulate. But they have their needs, they have their joys, they have their challenges, and they find all sorts of ways to communicate that to parents, to teachers, to the grown-ups around them. And it really takes a really intentional effort for us to be open enough to receive what is it that they're trying to communicate. And I think one of the reasons that Fred's work has had such a tremendous amount of impact on American families and children over the last 4 or 5 decades was his capacity to listen. And as right now in our work over the last 10 years, we're expanding that beyond just young children, but throughout the entire span of human development to youth, to teachers, to parents, to anyone who's out there helping children, helping community. Because I think, similar to what Tom and Michael are doing, we feel so strongly that listening is at the root of building and mending broken human relationships, which itself is at the root of isolation and loneliness that Michael and Tom were talking about.
And not only isolation and loneliness, but also the division we seem to have. I mean, I don't want to bring politics into it, but we seem to have a lot of divisiveness, not just in this country, but around the world. And many people have attributed that to not listening. And by listening, we mean really listening to one another. I saw something a while ago that I think that many people would agree with, is that when someone is in a conversation, and someone not referring to your clients, but someone is in a conversation, that often they are really not listening closely to the person they're speaking with, but thinking of their response instead of listening to what this person has to say, and then forming a thought as to, okay, how are we going to continue this conversation rather than responding. Dr. Li, you agree with that?
I think so, and I think so often what we are doing is that as we're listening, we are forming judgments, or often in the cases of division, we're forming pejorative judgments. We are assigning pejorative reasons to the person to whom we're listening. This is something that we learn a lot with working with children. So if you have a child who is acting out, and your first impulse could be, you know, if you are a teacher, you go, wow, here's a child who doesn't want to learn. I really wish this child isn't in my classroom. But if you listen deeper behind the acting out, you might see that here's a child who really wants to learn, but who is scared that he couldn't. And behind that behavior is a real need. And so instead of assigning a pejorative label to the child, you start to listen deeper for the need. And I think the same kind of approach or the same kind of patience and compassion can be extended far beyond the child arena, right? So if we listen to someone and they're saying something we just find offensive and we're taken aback by it, it doesn't mean we have to accept whatever is offensive, but it also requires us to listen deeper behind the words and see perhaps the hopelessness and despair from which that person is speaking.
Or maybe ask a question like, why do you think that way? Or instead of attacking, being judgmental. Michael and Tom, you've made a point of saying that when you're listening to someone that you're not being judgmental. How do you do that? Because so many people do it.
You're absolutely right. So many people do it. And there are times it's not always easy when we're listening to someone, and because they may say things that are offensive to us that we find abhorrent, but we also realize that there's a reason behind that. And Fred Rogers, if we understand, would often quote a social worker who had given him a note, and on it said, "There isn't anyone you couldn't love once you've heard their story." When we really, truly, intentionally listen, deeply listen to someone, we begin to hear things that begin to explain why perhaps they hold the opinions they have, do the things they do, say the things they say. Again, as June Lay said, it doesn't mean we have to accept or agree with what they say or what they do, but to begin to know why they do it or say it can make a big difference and help us to understand where they're coming from.
But, okay, how do you have a conversation with someone? And I wasn't even thinking about someone offensive. I'm just someone you disagree with. Maybe their lifestyle or their politics or their beliefs. But, you know, how do you have a conversation with a person like that when you do have differences of opinion?
For us, it really comes down to having a relationship. So I think for so many people in our world today, we make judgments about somebody where we don't have an authentic relationship. And so do we really have the right to tell somebody else that they're wrong without having a relationship, because they're just going to reject us? They're not
well,
really
apparently millions of Americans do.
That's right.
You're right.
They do. And we probably would disagree because we think that that's actually not helping foster deeper relationships. It's actually creating further division.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. You can see some of the shows that we're working on, such as Community Health Choices and Changing the State's Science Curriculum in Education. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking with someone to tell it to. And what it is we're talking, it's very simple. It may not be as simple as it sounds, but it sounds very simple. Listening to people, and this is an organization that listens when people are lonely. Maybe they're having some troubles in their lives. Maybe it's a medical issue. Maybe it's a family issue. But just someone to listen to, someone to tell it to, and the art of conversation and listening is something that goes a long way. Our guests today, Michael Ginrich and Tom Caden, co-founders and chief encouragement officers at Someone to Tell It To, and Dr. Junlei Lee, former executive director of the Fred Rogers Center, and he is currently senior lecturer in early childhood education at Harvard Graduate School of Education. He'll be the keynote speaker at Someone to Tell Solitude's gathering at Allenbury on September 29th. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Gentlemen, I question that just rose in my mind as I was giving the social media addresses where people can contact us. Does social media make it more difficult for people to have a conversation and to actually be listened to?
In many ways, it does, and we can name dozens of reasons and problems with social media. On the other hand, we also believe that social media is here to stay. It's not going away. There will probably be more and more of it. And so we need to learn how to use it well and healthily. We, in fact, have led an international seminar across five nations a couple of years ago on the use of social media and creating healthy relationships through social media. And we have many examples of people we've connected with, for instance, on Facebook private messaging, for example, who have... We have some profound discussions with them, you know, on that platform, for example. And we believe that there can be and there are ways to do that. For example, there's a Muslim man from Saudi Arabia who reached out to us through social media because he had read some things that we had written. And that's been ongoing for probably 5 years now. This man shares with us first the death of his father, which was very painful for him, and then the death of three of his children. Three children within 5 years have passed away. And we've also had a few phone conversations with that man. And what we would say is the pain of a father when he loses his father or his children is the same pain that any father would feel, no matter the language, no matter the country, no matter the culture, no matter the religion, no matter those differences. And we found that to be the case. And so we try to find the commonality, the common human experiences that we all have. And we've been able to do that, again, using him as an example. And we have some of the richest written conversations with this man. We just had one last week on the anniversary of September 11th because he reached out to us a few years ago on that day to express his sorrow to what happened in this country on that day. And as a Muslim man, how brokenhearted he was that took place.
Mm-hmm. Tom, you said that that basically what you do is preventive. In what way?
Yeah, we think it is preventative in a lot of ways because we see, you know, especially in the news today with a lot of mass shootings and a lot of violence, that we never really know the type of impact we are having through our listening because when you're entering into a relationship with someone, you never really know what the long-term effects could be, but we want to believe it's positive. We think of one woman that we had supported in Hershey, Pennsylvania, not too far from here, and she lives in Section 8 housing, and she's given us permission to tell this story. And we visited her in her home, and she would often say, I would go to sleep at night wishing I never woke up the next day. And she was very depressed, very lonely. But after having met with her for months and months, she would say to us, you know what, I don't pray that anymore. And it's all because we listened to her. You know, Fred would always say that listening is where love begins, listening to ourselves and to our neighbors. And so we do believe it's one of the greatest forms of love.
Dr. Lee, when Tom is talking about what they do as being preventive, it got me to thinking about children and whether this is something that can be taught to children to actually listen. Can it be?
I think so, but I think it may require us to expand our understanding of what teaching means. That your question reminds me of something that Mr. Rogers often said, which is that attitudes are caught, not taught. And as I expand kind of that work in early childhood as well as later ages, I think it may be appropriate to say that what the science of child and human development tell us is that attitudes like listening are caught and taught. And so I would imagine that one of the most important things that we can do as parents or teachers or anyone who's around a child or a young person is to model the very kind of attitudes and dispositions that we hope they would pick up. I would imagine that children learn from how we listen to them far more than learn from us telling them, this is how you should go listen to your peers.
You know, and I don't want to get too, you know, making psychological theories or anything else on this, but with children, as they're forming their confidence, their self-esteem, their value, does listening to them make them feel more valuable? And I'll ask the same question to you of adults. But Dr. Lee, I mean, when a child can perceive that someone actually listens to them, that it does help their self-esteem, it does help their confidence, that what I'm saying is valuable when this person is really listening.
Well, I think clearly in much of the research that emerges about the relationship children have with adults near them and the impact these relationships have on children from their academic to their mental health and so on, I think your hunch is absolutely right, that children learn and grow best through these relationships, and there's no basis for these relationships without a sense of listening. I think when children are listened to, they felt that they are received. And I'll give you just one single example that have really struck me. So one of the challenges we have across the country in schools that serve children from lower socioeconomic status and children of color is that our schools, right, have a tendency to overly punish and push out these children, and often results in suspension rates that are disproportional to children who are poor and children of color. So a while ago, a Stanford psychologist and his colleagues did this one particular intervention study where they went into schools, and they didn't, you know, do a whole school change on listening or anything. They just helped the math teachers in these middle schools to go through a very simple empathy exercise for them to think differently about the young people that they're with. And at the end of that school year, the suspension rates in these schools were cut in half just by intervening and supporting not all teachers, just the math teachers. And when you think about, you know, well, if I'm going to, I want to go to a school, I want to help people to listen and increase their empathy for young people, I would imagine that math teacher is not where you might start first. But what ended up happening is that just having one adult, right, in that environment, even the math teacher, to be able to listen to you, right? And so one of the important caveat in our study was that the math teachers didn't really change their disciplinary practice. So if they were going to give you a timeout or suspend you, they still would. The difference is not how they changed the disciplinary practice. It's that even while disciplining a student, they exemplified listening. They exemplified empathy. And that made the difference, right? So it's studies like that that help to illustrate, I think, your question, which is that there's something fundamental about being seen, being heard, being received as a human being, even if you're the one who's struggling, even if you're the one whose behaviors are disrupting your own learning and development as well as others. Even in these situations, having someone there to listen, to see, and to receive us can have a tremendously positive developmental impact.
You see the same thing with adults?
Absolutely. The name of our organization, Someone to Tell It To, comes from a quote from the Australian author Miles Franklin, and she wrote that someone to tell it to is one of the fundamental needs of human beings. We all need to be heard. We all need to be seen. We all need to know that people are hearing our stories and that they hear our life, that we're known. And so we see that in adults all the time.
I had a question here from a listener who wanted to know, what is your fee structure and where did you get your funding?
So we are a nonprofit, and we are strictly donation-based. So individuals can pay as they can, and thankfully we have a very supportive following at this point that's continuing to grow of people who believe in our work. But we also do charge businesses and organizations for our training resources, which has now been public probably in the last year and a half. And so we can get paid well for that, and that helps supplement the costs.
What kind of training, Tom? I didn't interrupt.
Yeah, so we have a training that's broken into about 7 modules, and it like the first, we think, is probably the most important place to start, is how we see people. And so the first module is all about seeing people with dignity and respect and kindness, because if we don't see people that way, then we aren't going to listen to them. So if we immediately start with preconceived judgments, we're not going to intentionally foster deeper relationships.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Michael Gingrich and Tom Caden, co-founders and chief. Oh, I should, one thing, because I'm sure there's listeners out there. How can they contact you if they need someone to listen to them?
Yeah, so anybody can reach out through our website, someonetotellitto.org. And just quickly to wrap this all together, we have an annual gathering, an annual fundraising benefit for our organization that is on September 29th, and June Lay is going to be our keynote speaker. We would love for you to attend. It's going to be at Allenberry Resort in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, again, September 29th from 3 to 5:30 p.m., and you can find out more information through our website, someonetotellitto.org.
Tom Caden, Michael Gingrich, co-founders, or Ginrich, I'm sorry, I called your wife Ginrich last week. Co-founders and chief encouragement officers at Someone to Tell It To, Dr. June Lay Lee, former executive director of the Fred Rogers Center and senior lecturer in early childhood education at Harvard Graduate School of Education. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Smart Talk at WYTF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about national security issues in the 2020 election. Some speakers are coming here to central Pennsylvania to talk about that, and we'll have them on the program tomorrow. You can visit our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on, plus leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. For years, Pennsylvania had one of the most restrictive fireworks laws in the country. But in 2017, the law was changed to allow Pennsylvanians to purchase and use consumer-grade fireworks. In the last 2 years, there have been many complaints about how often and when fireworks are being set off. Also, should mention where, because as you're going to hear from our guest today, concerned about fire hazards and the impact that they're having on pets. So to talk about maybe an amendment to the fireworks law of 2017, joining us today is Richard Rick Schutler, who is executive director of the Pennsylvania Municipal League. Rick Schutler, good to hear from you.
Thanks, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing well. Brian Ederlein is the chief of the Harrisburg Bureau of Fire. Chief Ederlein, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment about fireworks here in Pennsylvania, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Rick Schutler, you are the executive director of the Pennsylvania Municipal League, and you have heard from a lot of your members. In fact, the city of Lancaster, the city council, just recently was thinking about coming up with new laws that would address some of the fireworks situations in that city. Reading has already done that. What are you hearing from your members about the 2017 fireworks law?
Well, we're hearing that there have been a lot of issues, and I think no one really knew what to expect, but what has happened in many of our communities is that there are fireworks being set off that are way too close to existing buildings, in some cases unoccupied buildings or occupied buildings, but you know, places that are certainly susceptible to having a fire occur, people can get hurt, et cetera. And it's really sort of grown now as the law has been implemented and folks have been buying consumer-grade fireworks. So we really think we need to put some parameters around the law so that locally you know, folks like the chief and law enforcement can enforce reasonable laws to make sure to protect the rest of the public.
Chief Enterlein, you as a fire chief, obviously your big concern with this law is that there is potential for fire hazards or more injuries having to do with fireworks. Tell us about it.
You know, we've been, since the 2017 law took effect, we've been looking at this statewide and what has it really done to the fire service. And I can tell you, on July 4th weekend, we had three fires in the city, just in the city of Harrisburg, that were a direct result of fireworks being set off. And they were all being set off illegally, you know, in the city because of that 150-foot distance from a from an occupied or
okay,
other building.
So they were being set off within that 150-foot limit.
Correct. And, you know, you got to look at our cities and our urban areas. And it's not just Harrisburg. It's Scranton. It's Wilkes-Barre. It's Reading. You know, all these cities are dealing with the same thing. It is, we're so densely packed that there really is very little place, limited place, that you can set off fireworks. And make no mistake, I think the one thing that we miss, we have always in our cities had a illegal fireworks issue. The law just really allowed a closer network of facilities to buy those fireworks to be set off in our city. So, you know, when we look back 10, 15, 20 years, we were having fireworks issues in our cities. We had a fire pre-2017, a three-alarm fire on Penn Street that was a direct result of fireworks. At that point, you know, obviously they were illegal. So it really just put the fireworks at a closer proximity to our constituents, and now they're able to drive 10 miles instead of driving 200 miles into Maryland or somewhere else to buy them.
What is the big difference that you see? When I describe these fireworks as consumer grade, what's the big difference between 2017, post-2017, and before?
It really, you know, the only thing you were allowed to use was sparklers, punks, small things that put off a very small amount of sparks and things like that. Now the aerial fireworks and every fire that we've had on July 4th, 2019 in the city of Harrisburg was a result of some type of aerial firework being, you know, discharged literally in a front sidewalk within 15 feet of a property.
And we had a caller who asked this question. Since the law changed, is there any data regarding injuries related to the use of fireworks?
We as the fire service have been trying to look at that, and it becomes a difficult thing for us to gather that information because typically folks are going, not calling the fire department, and are going via ambulance to the hospital, get into a lot of statistics and stuff. And those statistics for 18 and 19 obviously haven't been released yet, but it is something that we also want to look at. We know that, you know, a child lost his life outside of Philadelphia this past year due to fireworks use. So we know that there's injuries happening. It's just a matter of being able to look at that data. Data is always a year or so out just because of the large volumes of it that need to be collected.
Rick Schuettler, the two of us spoke. We were at an event last night together, and I, you know, we were talking a little bit about this, and I just wanted to bring up the conversation we had last night, and that is that one of the things you hear most often from Pennsylvanians since this law was changed in 2017, they don't really think about the fire hazard is not at the front of their mind. You hear most often the complaints, the number of fireworks that you hear now, the time of the day when you hear them now, like late at night when people are trying to sleep, middle of the night, all times of day. What else? I mentioned pets. That many people, you know, I don't know what it says about us when we don't think of fire hazards as number one, but we think about our pets because it's something we can see and it has an impact on our homes, in our homes, that pets are afraid of the loud noises that they're hearing. Are these some of the things that you're hearing from your members across the state?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above, Scott. I certainly think the fire hazard is what's first, and the people hazard, the fact that people can get hurt doing this. You know, everyone's having fun, but then, you know, a good time goes bad because someone's setting it off in proximity to other people, and as the chief described, in denser areas, it's really an issue. If I just step back for a moment and say that, you know, we as a general rule, we believe in local government autonomy. We believe that we should not be preempted by state law, as we frequently are. This is a pretty big preemption of the right of local government to govern what's going on within the municipality, and really probably an unnecessary one. Shouldn't local government officials be the best ones to determine, you know, what level of fireworks and where they can be set off? That's what we're looking for, that sort of those parameters that we can then govern within. I would also describe this as really an unfunded mandate, because the bill allows the consumer fireworks. So now the chief is going out in more calls. His men are potentially in danger, because if you're going out in a call, it doesn't mean that it sounds benign. The call it can result in an incident. Same thing with police. Police are now out having to patrol more. Might mean more staffing. Might mean overtime. Who knows? And so we're looking for the ability for local government to govern themselves to determine what's best for their communities. And fireworks just fits in that category.
Well, as I mentioned, Reading had already done something, the Reading city government, and Lancaster City Council was going to, but decided to wait until, you know, we're going to talk about amendments that you're suggesting to the 2017 law in just a moment. But what parameters do cities, do municipalities have now? I mean, can't they enact their own fireworks laws?
Well, it really needs to be within the framework of the 2017 law. And certainly Reading and others had you know, laws in the books prohibiting things, and they did prohibit it before. But now you've got to operate within those parameters. And just to what you talked about, we just think that it's not going to be repealed, the law. So how can we amend the law so folks like Chief Enderlein and the police in Harrisburg can operate within it effectively and efficiently, and make sure that the public is safe? That's all we're looking for, is the ability to do that, and that's why we're going to seek some amendments, and we'll be presenting some of those. We work with the Fire Chiefs Association, the chief is part of, or a year ago, to come up with, you know, sort of a bulleted list of items that we'd like to see happen, because this issue was, you know, manifesting itself across the Commonwealth, as the chief indicated. And we came up with a number of things that we put in our policy, and now we'll actually seek to see if we can't get some sponsors to amend. We have a couple new bills out now, and so we'll see if we can take those a little step further.
Well, before we get into those proposed amendments, or at least suggested amendments, something you just mentioned, you made a pretty definitive statement when you said that this law is not going to be repealed. There's a reason why the law is probably not going to be repealed, and that is because the 2017 law was part of the budget package that, with the state looking for revenue, when they expanded what could be used in fireworks, those fireworks were taxed. So there's revenue coming from the expanded sale of fireworks here in Pennsylvania, and the political reality is that the law is probably not going to be repealed. It's here to stay. Correct, Rick?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's talk about the suggestions that you have for amending the law. What are they?
Well, we would ask for higher fines, and some of the bills do. Right now, I think, Chief, it's $100, and you know, you're sending police out, you know, for a potentially $100 fine. And again, keep in mind too that there's no revenue back to the community. Most of the fine money does not come back to the community, so we're looking for a more substantial fine. We'd say $1,000 would be good, and I think the bill says now not less than $100. So that we, you know, we're on the right track there. So we'd do $1,000. We would definitely be looking for increased density where you can set them off. 150 feet isn't enough. Those would be things. I think Chief mentioned data gathering. We need to start to gather data on it, because if you want to make your case about anything you're going to do in the future, or what the impact of this law is, it can't be anecdotal. We've got to start collecting data. We'd like to see that happen. I would also mention that there is a set aside within that the tax that does come back to EMS and to volunteer fire, but you know, career fire. And you know, we have both in our membership. We have career and volunteer, both extremely important. But career fire doesn't get any of that, and nor do police, who communities are going to be spending a lot of man hours and resources on enforcing what we have now. So those are a couple items. Chief may have others that he would that we talked about.
Chief, you know, Rick, and you know, I agree. I think the one group that we've really left out of the conversation, and I'm not sure it was done intentionally, has been the police departments. That $100 fine, it makes it, I mean, it's a slap in the face. These people spent $400 or $500 on fireworks. Yeah. That even if they are caught, prosecuted, and get the fine, $100 is just another thing for them, right? And the problem is, especially in cities, the police departments are already overwhelmed with low manpower, with the ability to respond to incidents, and that's any city across the Commonwealth. We're not just singling out Harrisburg or Reading or any. We're looking statewide. And it is a low priority call for them because, understand, by the time somebody calls and says, "Hey, somebody's setting off fireworks," the incident's already over. So now you gotta sort through and figure out and put somebody at the fireworks that were being set off. It's a very difficult task, and the police departments are really struggling with being able to to address those issues. I had a phone call about 10:30 on July 4th from an elderly city resident. Just a wonderful lady, and she called me all but in tears, and she said, "Brian, what can we do about this?" She said, "It is crazy at my house." And I happened to be in Reservoir Park at the time watching it, and, you know, unfortunately, I had to tell her there's not a lot we can do because by the time the police get there, it's over with. You know, as soon as they see that cop car coming down the street, everybody scatters. And that's across this Commonwealth, and that's the resounding thing that we're hearing from our police partners are, tell us how we're going to enforce this thing.
Well, and you as a fire department, as a firefighter, you have no power to say, you know, that's against the law, or, I mean, you verbally can do it, but you have no power to do anything about it, right?
Exactly. We have no arrest power. We have no power to, at this point, the way the bill's written, there's no power to the local fire department. And I would caution doing that because that sets us up for some other issues that could creep up on us. But it's a matter of, you know, how do we, you know, legitimately, we can put all the laws we want on a book, but if we can't enforce them and we can't do it efficiently, effectively, that makes sense for the local community, how do we make that happen without bringing swarms of police in on overtime, which is costing the municipalities and ultimately the taxpayers a ton of money?
On holidays.
On a holiday.
A lot of times, on the 4th of July.
If I might add, Scott, we're on holidays where you're already, and I don't want to get into the weeds of, you're already probably paying holiday pay, and now you might have, you know, so you have additional overtime related to this. The other thing I would say is, you know, one of the things we want is what the chief just spoke to on any amendments would be clear definition of municipal authority with the ability to opt out if you would like to, so we can make our own rules as in that community. Those are the kind of things that we would want in any amendments. Time will tell, and we'll see as this progresses what we can do, what we can't do. But I think that would be very helpful, and I think the public wants it.
The emails I'm seeing, I have one here from Jan, says, "I'm in favor of amendments to the current fireworks law for all the reasons mentioned. Also, I don't believe people should be able to set off fireworks anytime or any day they feel like it." Also had someone who said that where she lives, there is a noise ordinance. Wouldn't fireworks being set off, if, you know, it breaks that new noise ordinance, wouldn't it take care of some of these issues?
Wow. you know, noise ordinance, I don't know what that noise ordinance says, but sometimes it can actually get into decibel level. And so you would actually be measuring the decibel level. You could have that conflict between, whether a local ordinance could preempt a state law that says you can set these off as it exists today. Sounds murky to me. But I don't know how enforceable that would be, frankly.
Had another caller who said that lives in a small borough in Lancaster County, 2 children, 2 dogs. Dog is quite old, scared of fireworks. These fireworks have become more available, have neighbors live within close proximity, have habitually set them off, and the dog is scared. We are out of time, almost out of time, I should say. Rick, so what happens with these suggestions that you're making for amendments?
Well, we'll be putting them forward. There's a hearing in, I think, another week or so. and we'll be presenting, providing testimony that does a few of the things. I know the Chiefs Association is doing the same. Chief Delaney, Chief Enterline's colleague from Wilkes-Barre, and we're on the same page in terms of what we would like to see happen. And I think we'll put forth an effort to see if we can't make it happen.
Rick Schuttler is executive director of the Pennsylvania Municipal League, and Brian Enterline is chief of the Harrisburg Bureau of Fire. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll be talking about foreign policy in the 2020 elections. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.